Hello, this is Mark Ames. That was a little loud. With the seventh, I believe, the seventh episode of Radio War Nerd, sponsored by you, the subscribers. And I'm here in the financial capital of the universe, New York City. And I'm on the line now with the War Nerd himself, aka Gary Brecher, aka John Dolan. And John, can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you. You hear me?
Yeah, I do. Slightly faint, but you get around. Where are you right now? If you could tell listeners where you are.
Yeah, what if I could? We're at some Turkish airport, but it's not the usual Istanbul airport. We're trying to get from Athens to Budapest, and in a panic, I bought a cheap-looking ticket and didn't notice that it had a 20-hour layover in Istanbul, but not normal Istanbul. It's one of those things where you look out the window of the plane, and all you see is like these forested hills, and you think, that's not Istanbul. I think we're somewhere near Bursa, but all I know is we just grabbed a place in the airport hotel.
I see. So is it like your typical, airport hotel, sort of comfortable, a little bit of cigarette smell, a decent buffet,
Yeah, overpriced with
overpriced?
service, like yeah, we can't really afford it, but there's no alternative. And the guy who insists on grabbing your bags and helping you to your room. I mean, I have a sort of lower middle class problem with service. Service makes me nervous. I mean, there's a reason they rhyme. And I don't like people touching my bags and things.
Yeah, anybody calls me Francis, I'll kill you. So, but I was just thinking though, in Turkey, I mean, the Warner has been pretty critical of Turkey. I don't mean to get any fears or paranoias up. You're going to be out of there soon, and don't even think about that old movie, Midnight, whatever the hell it was called. I can't remember. The best version of which was the SCTV version where Abbott and Costello tried to mule heroin out of Turkey and gets thrown into prison. But that's for another time. But what didn't happen? Didn't it just happen recently that a British woman, I forget if she was a human rights activist or a journalist, was found very mysteriously
Yep.
hung in a bathroom on a stopover or something.
Yeah. I think it was in the Istanbul airport. She supposedly, while waiting for a plane to Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan, just had a notion to hang herself in the women's toilet of the Istanbul airport. And as I pointed out on Facebook on my Warner page there, that funny things happen to women journalists in Turkey who try to go against the regime. I mean, one of them was killed in a very strange traffic accident just across the border from Kobani at the height of the siege. She was a Shia reporter, Shia Lebanese American, who was reporting for Iranian TV, and she got smashed by a cement truck, which is one way of,
Oof.
making sure that the
God.
problem's solved. And now this woman decided, this British woman decided to kill herself in an airport toilet. I just can't see it. I mean, as a long-term depressive who's certainly, imagined various venues for a permanent solution, I just don't see transferring, middle of a long flight, transferring between planes. I can see, homicide at that moment, but it's not a suicidal moment.
No. In fact, it reminds me almost a little bit of you remember you wrote about the I think it was a woman, right, in one of the Gulf states, maybe it was even Kuwait, who was followed into the bathroom at a mall and killed
Yeah.
there.
Yeah. It was a mall either in Abu Dhabi or Dubai. I think Abu Dhabi. Yeah, it was a Romanian American woman who was followed in there by a Yemeni woman who had moved to the Gulf and later claimed to be schizophrenic, although there was obviously a sectarian motive as well. Yeah, and she just got hacked to death in this toilet there. And there was an incredible sort of footage of this figure in all black with complete niqab and hijab, going into the elevator at the mall. It was very much like that scene from The Ring.
Right. So I just want to tell listeners, in case, you know, the quality on this one may be a little bit off again. I mean, the Warnerd is getting around like a true sort of Warnerd refugee all around the southern part of Europe. And so you've just gone from Italy to Athens. Now you're in Turkey and you're heading to Hungary, right?
Yeah. My wife, Catherine, ran the Athens Marathon, and we had an eventful week in Athens. I mean, I want to talk about that later because we saw some amazing museums, but we also got robbed, and it was
hence the microphone problem, right?
Yeah,
now.
So we're using a new microphone. If there are any problems, that's why.
So we'll get better mic set up again when you're in the westernmost province of the former Empire of Attila the Hun. Is that right?
Yeah. Made it to. The people who almost beat the Mongols.
That's right. So, all right. So we're going to do something a little bit different, which is we're going to go back to something we tried out earlier on, which we used to do, which was Around the Wars in 8 minutes, trying to do 8 wars in 8 minutes. And the Warnerd has assured me that he thinks he can actually do it. And I've got a timer here. With a kind of cheesy, with a cheesy sound. So I'm gonna. Are you ready to go?
Yeah, I mean, we should tell the listeners that the plan is, when we can afford it, we'll get a little electroshock system for my chair, so that if I fail in doing each of these in less than 60 seconds, I'll get a little reminder.
Yes. The old tweezing the eyes open and the whole thing. Okay, yeah. Good. Yeah, I like that. All right, good. So tell me when you're ready to go. We're going to do 8 wars that are going on around the world or on his mind. And remember, today is Veterans Day or Remembrance Day, and we'll talk about that in a minute too, but it's the 11th of November, 2015. So, you know, what better way to honor veterans than by doing 8 wars in 8 minutes?
Yep.
We still care. Okay. All right, and 3, 2, 1, go!
Syria. All right, you may have heard all these stories in the Western press about, oh, the Russian airstrikes have failed. Russia is heading for disaster. Well, the Syrian Arab Army, SAA, Assad's forces, just retook the air base south of Aleppo in a town called Qeres. That has been under siege for 2 years. By various Sunni jihadi militias, mostly Islamic State. And those SAA forces, who are really not great infantry, finally broke through with the help of the Russian airstrikes. They broke the siege. The air base is now firmly in their hands. And it should get a lot harder to talk about the Russian airstrikes failing. It won't, but it should.
Right, I saw that. And I also saw that they're now going to move on to Palmyra.
Yeah, that should be fairly easy. That, I mean, Palmyra is a very isolated place. It was kind of a...
Boom, next okay. War.
Okay, Burundi. You've heard a lot about Burundi. There's trouble in Burundi. Oh, there may be trouble. But nobody will say, honestly, except African media, that what's going on there is that there's a quasi-dictator, a strange guy named Pierre Nkurunziza, who is a former Hutu militia officer, who is now trying to prolong his stay in power by directing classic massacres of Tutsi Burundians and stirring up ethnic hatred. There are bodies horribly mutilated turning up in Tutsi neighborhoods, and he's using the cry "We will spray you," as in cockroaches, because cockroaches was the code word for Tutsi in the similar genocidal attacks just across the border in Rwanda. So what you won't hear from the Western media, this is ethnic violence, like it or not. That's
boom. War number 3,
Sharm el Sheikh. Russian jet blown out of the sky, or fell out of the sky at any rate. And you heard all over that this was almost certainly, and that was always the phrase, almost certainly a bomb. Originally they thought a missile, and then they went to a bomb, probably altimeter triggered. But it's a little strange. This is still a theory. And you and I, Mark, have both taken those charters, and we know what shitty airplanes they are. And there are a lot of other reasons that might fall out of the sky. So I'm still waiting to hear some real proof that this was a bomb. And I still haven't heard it. The latest is that some British jihadis with Birmingham accents, which is a joke in itself in British terms, were celebrating 23 minutes after the attack. And I don't know exactly what that proves.
As you would say, Ali Jihadi. Or...
Exactly. Those guys, who are kind of a joke in themselves. And that's still not the best proof.
Boom, war number four.
Okay, Turkey. Erdogan won the elections. I mean, he would have had to enter a coalition, so he just sort of delayed, staged new elections, and made sure Turkey had a lot of awful violence in the meantime. And what a lot of people are reluctant to understand is that violence tends to help right-wing populist leaders, and often the worse the violence, the more it helps them. Mm-hmm. You saw that with Putin when he came to power after those god-awful apartment bombings.
Mm-hmm. Modi.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Modi. Mm-hmm. Even, Bush with 9/11. I mean, mm-hmm. an atrocity can really help someone who's willing to talk in violent patriotic cliches, and Erdogan is the perfect example. This is very bad news for the Kurds, and in the long run, it's bad news for Turkey, too, but he's back in power.
Okay. Wow, you made that one in under time. We're just about to hit number five. Okay, go ahead.
In response to Turkish airstrikes, the PKK, the Kurdish militia in southeastern Turkey, virtually identical to the YPG across the border in Syria, is now attacking Turkish security forces. This is classic urban guerrilla stuff. But the trouble is the Turkish state, the dominant state, the occupier, always controls the media. So what you hear about is the two or three cops who get killed mm-hmm. by the PKK. You never hear about the dozens of villagers who were blown to bits by those same security forces before the pressure of the civilian Kurdish population forced the PKK to retaliate, which it probably doesn't want to do because it's not a good move. But these people have responsibilities too. An urban guerrilla group has a responsibility to its own population mm-hmm. who kind of want some vengeance once in a while after they've seen.
And they have to prove that they have credibility.
Yeah, right? They have to prove that.
Oh, okay, war number six.
Yemen, strange story. I mean, Yemen is still hell on earth with the Saudis bombing anything in sight and the Houthi, the Shia rebels digging in and occasionally trying to strike back across the border. But in the middle of all this, and I really don't know what to make out of this except that it's something pretty murky and spy-like, a U.S. contractor was captured after coming into Sana'a from Djibouti. And Djibouti? Mm. Why would you fly from Djibouti to Sana'a if you're an American, quote, contractor? The Houthi naturally asked themselves that question and kept him in captivity and perhaps, did some things to him to make him tell them with a little more alacrity. And now he's dead. And I really don't know what to make of all that, except that it sounds like, among other things, gross incompetence by one or the other three-letter agencies.
Mm. It reminds me, there was an Intercept writer that they had to extract from Yemen. Okay, number seven, go.
Boko Haram. You've heard a lot about Boko Haram. Classic African rural insurgency where the goal is not so much to kill huge populations directly, but to force them into flight, because when you're forced into flight in a tropical, especially an arid tropical area, huge numbers of you are going to die. Boko Haram has been doing that in northern Nigeria under the incredibly incompetent rule of Goodluck Jonathan and the Nigerian army. They have a new ruler in Nigeria now who's effectively put pressure on Boko Haram, and as a result, Boko Haram has been moving across the borders. This is one of the things you can do as a rural guerrilla group, move across national borders. So they're moving to Chad, mm-hmm. and Chad has now declared a state of emergency, which should be interesting because Chad's army is not a joke, unlike Nigeria's army. Chad kicked the shit out of the Libyans long ago.
I want to hear more about Chad, and I'm sure our listeners would want to as well, and Chad, Libya. But now let's go on to the eighth and final war, 8 minutes. You're doing it. It's amazing. So, boom, number eight.
Okay. Palestine. I mean, I feel like I ignore Palestine, Israel, because, you know, it's just kind of depressing. But the latest episode has been the War of the Knives, and mm-hmm. and I think it's kind of hard to understand this. Like, again, it's sort of like what I was saying about the PKK. Like, when you don't have the weapons, you have to fight ugly. And since you also don't control the media, the stories people hear about how ugly you're fighting. Latest one is in response to the Israeli administration under Netanyahu closing off the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa Mosque, young Palestinians, very young, averaging around 16, 17, have been taking kitchen knives and stabbing Israelis. And, you know, the reason for that is, you know, because they don't have Hellfire missiles. I mean, mm-hmm. that's really the simplest explanation.
Okay, that's it. You want to finish that last thought up? Because there are also people using their cars.
Yes.
I mean, you know, it's sort of, and a car becomes a weapon, as you've you know, talked about before.
Yeah, cars are becoming weapons quite often now, mm-hmm. it seems. Like that strange episode in Oklahoma where that woman lost her job at some... Right. diner and responded by driving into a parade. I mean, yeah, a car is a terrifying weapon, and yeah. almost anything is a terrifying weapon if you're willing to use it as such. I mean, a Uniball pen could do some horrible damage if...
Casino, Joe Pesci.
Yeah, right in the neck. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so these weapons, oddly enough, tend to scare people more than high-tech weapons, even though their killing potential is far lower. You can see that in horror movies, too. People are more afraid mm-hmm. of an axe than a gun, although you're really much better off getting hit with an axe than a gun.
Or because... a pencil in the ankle, as in yeah. Evil Dead, you know. Yeah, there's something just gruesome about it, because I guess it's because they're not considered weapons, and suddenly you start thinking yep. how vulnerable your flesh and body is to all kinds of things.
Yeah.
It's not fair. It's not the rules, but actually... Yeah.
And it's associated with people who aren't legitimate players. I
right.
mean, when you have someone in uniform full of high-tech weaponry, it's like their proper job to use those weapons. But somebody who just walks up to you at a bus stop and maims you with some tool is not playing by the rules.
Yeah, savage.
Yeah.
I mean, that's. I think you said it once, the definition of a terrorist is somebody who doesn't have an Air Force to call.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So, I guess right now, let's just, that was great, by the way, because I know that's really hard, and I remember we've tried it a few times, and, it was hard. I mean, can I ask you, what's the secret? Did you practice it a little bit this time, or do we keep this a mystery?
I've got a clock in front of me with a second hand.
Okay.
So that really helps.
So today is, Veterans Day. Do you want to speak a little bit about Veterans Day today? I mean, it's one of the holidays. I mean, I don't ever really celebrating it, except they close like the post office and perhaps banks. I can't even remember if we got school off on Veterans Day. I don't think we did.
Yeah, it's a much bigger thing in the Commonwealth, especially because people may not know this, but I lived in New Zealand for over a decade. And in New Zealand, November 11th is a huge day because this is the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, which was when, with a strangely poetic, gory sense of timing, the Entente, the Allies, decided to officially end World War I on November 11th, 1918. And by that time, when you drive around South Island, New Zealand, you often see tiny little hamlets, you know, where there's maybe a couple hundred people. And then in the middle of the town, what there is of it, there'll be a big stone monument, and there's a list of names of the dead from World War I, mostly from Gallipoli, on those things. And often there are more dead on that, carved on that stone, than there are actually living in the town. So that really drove it home to me, what a monstrous war this was for many countries, much more so than for the U.S. In the U.S., I think World War I is kind of a vague memory. World War II is a much more vivid one, or the mm-hmm. Civil War. Those mean a lot more. And we have only a vague sense of how the war ended, but because it ended in a very strange way. I mean, that led directly to the Second War. I mean, by the end of the war, even on November 11, 1918, there was not one single French, British, American, or Russian troop soldiers inside the borders of Germany. Mm-hmm. And they were pretty big borders, so that's quite remarkable. And you can see how that would lead to the stab in the back theory, mm-hmm. because after all, people didn't see foreign troops moving through their towns. They didn't go through the horrors that especially Eastern Germany went through in 1945. But what had happened was that, you know, the German military was intermittently very rational, and they had simply gamed it out in a pre-computer way, and they realized there's no more chance. We have no more manpower, we have no more industry, we have nothing left. And their allies were starting to abandon them. Mm-hmm. First, Bulgaria left. I mean, it's weird to think of Bulgaria as an important ally, but it was a lot bigger at the time. Bulgaria mattered a bit. Then the Ottoman Empire made a separate peace with the Entente. And then Austria-Hungary, which was beginning to lose to the Italians. I mean, give the Italians a little credit. Mm-hmm. A lot of Italian forces fought pretty well in World War I. And suddenly they were without allies, without any resources left. And they had planned to send the North Sea fleet out again. And this is something you see a lot around 1918. It's the sailors, like in Kronstadt, mm-hmm. you know, for the Russians. It's the sailors who mutiny. The sailors mm-hmm. have a reputation for radicalism. They mutinied. They took over towns in northern Germany. A republic was declared, and the Kaiser fled, and it was clearly time to end this thing. Mm-hmm. And the German military decided to do so. And around 5 a.m. on the morning of November 18th, they reached what was called an agreement, which was basically vengeful demand for absolute surrender from Germany, which they got. And they didn't end it right then because, as I've said before, these are pre-1918 people, and they weren't like us. And they thought it was a beautiful idea to end it on, as I said, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. So there were
they were thinking about their parades already.
Exactly.
And their parades and the whatever is going to be written in the papers and the speeches and whoever, you know, the state poems and so on.
Yeah, yeah, poems especially. They were very, very fond of gory, beautiful ideas. And to us, that's an oxymoron. To them, not so much. In fact, when Yeats comes up with the oxymoron, a terrible beauty is born, I think it was only after 1920 that could have been recognized as an oxymoron. Until then, a terrible beauty was just, yeah, that's what beauty's like. So they wanted that timing. And in the process, there were 10,000 extra casualties because some units decided, ah, the hell with it, we're going to stop right now, because they got the message around 6 a.m. or something. Mm-hmm. Other units decided, no, we go till the last minute. And there was a lot of inadvertent comedy in the last minutes of this war. Like the very last soldier killed in World War I, and I say this with a mixture of pride and embarrassment, was an American soldier named Henry Gunther, who died at 10:59 and several seconds a.m. November 11th, 1918, while charging, as far as I know, on his own, charging at a German unit that sort of watched in puzzlement as a single...
Maybe his watch was off by a minute or so.
Wait, I got time. Hey.
I'll do this. I'll show them that I'm not really Germanic, you know, that's Gunther name. I'll charge them. But you know, time out, you know.
And so finally, one of the German soldiers said, you know, but he's pointing a rifle at us. And they shot him, and he died. with like several seconds to spare. And a few minutes before that, this is one of those stories that I find it hard to credit because it seems like some sort of stereotype. Well, they also, frankly, Henry Gunther sounds like a stereotype, mm-hmm. as you said, a coach's son.
Yeah, coach's son.
But the last French casualty supposedly was Augustin Trebuchon, who was killed at 10:45 a.m. on November 11th, 1918, supposedly, and I don't believe this, on his way to tell his fellow soldiers that in honor of the armistice, hot soup would be served for lunch that day.
Yeah, that sounds a little too
It's
Euro.
A little – sounds like a – one of the stories us Anglos tell about the French. I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. But so there, it's a beautiful little glimpse into what, you know, in a P.G. Woodhouse novel you get called pre-war. I mean, in P.G. Woodhouse novels, a heroine will say, oh dear, aunt is acting very pre-war today, which means insanely arrogant and brave and stupid all at the same time.
And full of sort of romantic notions about romantic death and fighting. Illusions. Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was, so this was the war that created then a whole generation of disillusioned, the first of many, I guess, right? But just these disillusioned generations and some great writers. I mean, some great books and these novels. I mean, Journey to the End of the Night, of course, Celine, you know, Farewell to Arms, if you have to choose a Hemingway. That was pretty good, I thought, if I remember.
Yeah, you have to admit, Hemingway wrote a great novel there.
Yeah.
I mean, Farewell to Arms is a great novel. I mean, in fact, we were talking before about how people died in that war, and he has one of the most beautiful descriptions of what it was like to get killed in World War One. And as his girlfriend, Catherine Barclay, says about her former fiancé, I thought it would be romantic and he'd get shot in the shoulder and I could go find him and patch him up, but there was no body. They blew him to pieces. And that's how Hemingway and his Italian medical orderly friends get targeted. They're eating pasta with cheese in some supposedly bomb-proof bunker, and the Austrians start shelling, and they're sort of casually talking about kind of mortars. And they say, oh yeah, that's a 420 millimeter mortar. Those things are bad. And then they start getting closer, and then Hemingway says, there was a sound like a freight train coming into a station. And then his knee is gone, and his friends are screaming, and those of them who are still alive. You know, there's no romance in that kind of killing. It's just waiting in a hole to be blown to pieces.
That was the part. Now, again, I read All Quiet on the Western Front when I was, 14, 15. So it may not be a good book, but I do remember that was sort of the point of that book too, that all the deaths were really, they just were not romantic, heroic deaths or you know, limbs getting lost and amputations and so on. Just a lot of mud, screaming, you know, a lot of accidental deaths or stupid deaths. I just remember the guy who had his nose part of the front of his face lopped off by somebody's bayonet when he turned the wrong way. So, yeah, that seemed to be a pretty common theme. I mean, because it wasn't a mobile war until the end. It was more mobile in the East, right?
Yeah.
But definitely on the West, it wasn't a mobile war. And actually, at the end, though, the Germans, I mean, they realized that they kind of had one big last chance, right, that spring and summer.
Yeah.
And they did move the lines a lot, and then they just collapsed.
Yeah.
And the Americans had just come up to full force, and then that was it. So you were just saying the Americans invested a lot into the war, which all came to fruition sort of in those last months, right, in 1918.
Yeah, the American effort was fresh. They hadn't been involved in the war for a long time. You know, the 1916 election slogan was Wilson. He kept us out of war, and then he, you know, brought him into war, but at a good time when most of the other powers were completely exhausted or knocked out of the war in the Russian case, and it was enough to cause quite a swing, and there was no sense that it was ever going to end. The the investment was going to go on and on, and Germany had limited manpower, limited money, limited industry to invest in. It had all been used, and above all, its allies were deserting it left and right. I mean, Bulgaria, the Ottoman Empire, even Austria-Hungary,
right, which fell apart basically.
Yeah, which disintegrated.
Right,
and so did the Ottoman Empire, completely disintegrated, and what was considered Bulgaria actually was pretty much destroyed too. So there was really nothing left. But also there was this shock among the German population because they hadn't seen foreign soldiers marching through their cities. I mean, when you do see that, you learn something, but it's usually a very expensive lesson. So it's not something you really want to learn, but it did allow for a lot of classic Alex Jones type fantasies. And, you know, if you want to...
Vietnam War. Stab in the back theory. I mean, we did that, you know, and we lost the war. We, America, lost the war there, but and we didn't really suffer for it. We suffered mentally somehow.
Yeah, yeah. And even so, we invented a lot of lies, like the veterans being spat on all over the place, which, as far as I know, was not the case. I mean, Nixon had to pardon Lieutenant Calley because the majority of the American population thought Calley was great, and that was after My Lai had been proved. And their only objection was that the war was not won, not that it was conducted in a pretty...
It reminds me, you know, of this this one vignette in this kind of painful book by, I think his name is Milton Hindu. He was the was he a Oberlin professor? He was one of those college liberal arts colleges.
Hindus,
yeah.
Yeah.
And he goes out to, he was a big fan of Salines, who was, you know, a raging anti-Semite, but a great comic writer, sort of invented black humor. After the war, Saline escaped. He was basically with the collaborators of Vichy government. He escaped. He eventually was jailed in Denmark, and he stayed there and hid out because the French wanted to hang him for a few years. So Milton Hindus, this Jewish American professor, comes out to meet him and sort of just wants to meet this guy that obviously affected his life so much. It's very painful reading. But there are some great scenes in it. He does a pretty good job of recounting the things Saline says to him. He's usually very disappointed in it, but when you're the reader, it's kind of funny. And one of the things, the anecdotes that Saline tells him, I mean, this guy's basically looking for some kind of deep spiritual wisdom, and Saline just wants food, stockings for his wife, and to live and to get the hell out of there, you know. So he kind of has the, I don't know, charm him for a while as much as he can stand him, and he clearly can't stand the professor. It's very painful. But in any event, Saline tells this great anecdote that Milton Hindus writes about, where he says it's about some French professor of the history of Western civilization, and he's taught at the Sorbonne all his life, and he finally retires at like age 90, and he's, you know, got all these accolades and awards, and he's put out books. And then he finally takes his first trip around the world. And so he spends about a year or two traveling around the world. And he finally comes back and he says, "What I learned from traveling the world is basically everything I've taught is complete bunk. All civilizations only care about two things, the last war that they won and the next war that they will win."
Wow. Wow, that's beautiful.
It's amazing, I know.
Yeah. That tallies very nicely. This is one of those smooth segues for which you and I are so justly famous. With what I wanted to talk about, which is the whole experience of being in Athens and going to Greek war museums.
Yes.
And learning what I can about the Greco-Turkish War, which was one of the biggest and most horrific wars of the 20th century, and yet is almost totally ignored. And what it comes down to is defeat. I mean, basically, when you deal with the Greek experience, it's overwhelmingly one of defeat. And I'm not just talking about recently. Mm-hmm. I mean, going back to the 6th century. I mean, as a grad student in the 80s, I was raised on Edward Said and Orientalism and all this. But when you look at the history of the Eastern Mediterranean from the Greek perspective, you see something quite opposite. You see what the Greeks see as their Christian Orthodox culture losing constantly and steadily to a push from the East by Muslim cultures. And the big event in this, of course, is the fall of Constantinople in 1453. I mean, one of the things I saw this week was in the Greek War Museum, a gigantic, twice life-size sarcophagus of Constantine the 11th, the last Byzantine emperor. And as a little war nerd, you know, like 12 years old, I remembered the description of him in my encyclopedia, Constantine the 11th, the last Byzantine emperor who died fighting on the walls. And I just thought, ah, who died fighting on the walls? How cool. Except, you know, it isn't really so cool when you grow up and you imagine what that would mean to someone who, for example, has a family, has daughters, it would not be so good. But the Byzantine Empire, which is the big thing in Greek history, a continuation of the Roman Empire, which spoke Greek, adopted Orthodox Christianity, dominated everything from parts of coastal Spain to Luxor and Lower Egypt. That hit its peak around 600 AD.
I'm sorry to butt in real quickly, but I think also you have to remember that in the Roman Empire, the Romans were kind of, I mean, the big jock, but hicks, and they really relied on the Greeks, right, for all kinds of things. I mean, you get this, you kind of even get a bit of that when you read Saul and Bo, but like the Greeks were sort of the smart asses. They didn't have enough muscle, but they were very powerful back at that time, right? So
And in the, oh, by the way, this is something else I got to tell everybody. In the beginning, they did have muscle, and that's what brings me to Thermopylae, because this is something I should have known. I'm ashamed to say I didn't know this, but we went to the Greek War Museum, which is quite an experience in its own right, very strange. They have some very detailed exhibits on Thermopylae. And yeah, there were 300 Spartans at Thermopylae. But what nobody remembers is there were, and this is going to hurt all those jocks who worship the Spartans, there were 700 thespians. Yes, that's thespians. So the sequel, I think, should be 700, 2.33 times as epic and way more thespian.
That's funny. Yeah, yes. I'd like to see who's that graphic, the you know, the comic writer. Yeah,
Frank Miller. Or
that's
something.
Right. Yeah, that asshole. Yeah.
The thespians.
Yeah. thespians arise! You know,
they didn't know that their name would get used by actors later on. It was just a city near Thebes. And there, by the way, there were also 400 Thebans. Mm-hmm. So the total force was well over 1,000. It wasn't just 300 Spartans. I mean, to be fair, the Spartans were damned good heavy infantry, and that's what you need blocking a pass like that. Mm-hmm. But they were outnumbered by these thespians and these Thebans. Who also died. You know, there had been many thousand Greeks, I think about 10,000 Greeks blocking the pass, and then they were outflanked. They decided it was hopeless, but this thousand-odd force remained, and the Spartans were less than a third of it.
Well, and war nerds, the Max Boots, the younger Mark Ameses and John Dolans, were... But no matter what, when you read Greek history, and we did, you know, my dad even got me into it when I was younger, and then, of course, in rhetoric and reading Thucydides, I mean, the Spartans were cool and evil and scary, sort of like the Germans, right? I mean, and that's why grown-up neocon fascists still love them.
Yeah. In fact, I had an interesting discussion with a friend of yours, Costas, about this, and I said... it feels weird to me that I'm in Athens now and there are all these t-shirts saying this is Sparta, because, you know, this isn't Sparta. This is the side I don't like versus Athens, the side I do like in the Peloponnesian War. And he said, No. The Spartans represented a different side of Greek civilization, and he used a sort of Cold War analogy that the Spartans are more like the Soviets, I suppose. But I mean, the Soviets had a bunch of writers who were pretty good. They had musicians and stuff. Spartans, I don't know. They had spears. and by the way, we saw a lot of amazing weapons in Athens. I mean, okay, I don't do weapons as a rule, but that doesn't mean I don't love the weird stuff when you finally get to see it. Like, we saw something that's mentioned in the Iliad, the Thracian two-handed sword. And I didn't quite imagine what this was like. I thought it might be just a bigger straight sword. But no, if you can imagine a giant samurai sword with that slight curve that the samurai swords have, it's like that. And it's huge.
A double grip or what?
Yeah, yeah. Oh. You're supposed to hold it with two hands. And it's like two, maybe three times the size of a samurai sword.
I see. So it's like Bjorn Borg's backhand or something. With a double-handed backhand. Okay.
Yeah, I think they called it a falx, but it would be a terrifying weapon. I mean, and for me, because I've been doing a version of the Iliad that I hope will bring it not just...
It's fantastic. I mean, it's just one of the greatest things I've read, yeah. So everybody has something to look forward to in life. I'm not going to kill myself yet. No, it's really great, yeah.
Well, one thing I was wondering about, based on the exhibits I saw in Athens, is what shape are the shields? Because there's no sense in the Iliad that the shields are anything but round, you know, like a bunch of discs of oxhide and maybe some metal. But in the archaeology museum, there are a lot of shields from that era that represent the so-called figure eight shape. And it seems awfully fancy and strange. And now I'm starting to worry about what shape the shields should be. And if anybody wants to talk to me about that, I'm happy.
They have hourglass bodies, you know, thin waists and, you know.
I know. Well, shield shape is really interesting. I mean, I wonder if anybody, and we have people who know a lot more than I do about contemporary simulation technology. I wonder if anybody has come up with the ergonomically perfect shield, although I suppose it would depend on what weapons you're expecting to face. Mm-hmm. Because, like, we also saw Persian shields from the Persian Wars, and the Persian shields are kind of cool looking, but I don't know how well they'd work. They're shaped sort of like flattened crescents, as if they dip in the middle so you can look over it. But the trouble with looking over your shield is that, somebody can look in with a spear point or something like that, or an arrow. So I don't know. I mean, if anybody knows, if anybody has ever tried a computer simulation, what's the best shield shape against, say, a volley of arrows or an enemy armed with a spear or an enemy armed with a shield? I would think that there'd be different designs for each of those depending on what you're expecting to face. But maybe we can apply some 21st century technology to that.
Yeah, we should have some tech nerds listening, subscribing.
Wow, I would certainly hope so.
Yeah, better.
Bitterly disappointed if we didn't. But the most amazing weapon we saw was a Byzantine bazooka. I mean, I've always loved the Byzantines. I mean, they don't get no respect, but they were so cool. I mean, you may have heard of Greek fire. You know, this was one of their mainly naval weapons. They had a way of projecting burning pitch at enemy ships that terrified fleets. They burned a Slavic fleet to the waterline, even though it was like 10 times their size. And we saw various things they used to project this burning pitch, burning oil, basically, napalm, essentially. And it was a secret recipe, some kind of napalm recipe. But we saw something I never would have believed existed from a 10th century manuscript, an illustration of a handheld Greek fire dispenser that's an awful lot like a flamethrower from World War II.
Wow.
And they actually had a reproduction of it, which is, you know, probably made 20 years ago based on this illustration, so who knows. But
that's amazing.
Yeah, the illustration from the 10th century shows someone on a siege tower squirting fire from this handheld thing, almost like an exterminator's bug squirter.
That's kind of like the World War One, the very early prototype. I mean, World War One did have some really cool early prototype weapons that later got a little too slick, but I think they had flamethrowers at the very end of the war.
Yep.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Sorry, yeah, same sort of design. Incredible stuff. But then, you know, as I said, the problem with the Byzantines is that it's always a losing cause. I mean, the Western Romans had basically minor enemies to deal with.
Vandals. The big
stuff always came from the East.
Right. Actually, and that's another point. And then I want to get to sort of the more modern war. But, you know, there's this idea that we constantly hear about the Roman Empire always. I mean, all we know about it is that it degenerated and collapsed. But the damn thing lasted a long time.
Yeah.
And if you include the Byzantine Empire as, you know, the successor of it, it lasted a really long time. I mean, any empire should be so goddamn lucky to last 1,500 years.
Absolutely. If you plug in a human lifetime to that, especially a pre-antibiotic human lifetime, you're not going to see the end of the empire. The odds are the empire is going to be there before you're born and be there after you're dead, and you're not going to see any big change in it except maybe expansion, and you have some vague rumor that, hey, we took another country somewhere over there that I can't even, you know, find on a map, if there even was a map. It was immensely powerful. And when my friend Annibale took me around Aosta, a Roman town in northern Italy, I could see it, because as he kept explaining to me, and I think this is really important, in a world where threats are the only thing that operated most of the time, the Romans offered you something more than a threat. They offered you benefits.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see your children grow up without war. You won't have to see them, you know, held up in front of you and watch their throats slit. That was a big deal. And not only that, you'll have these magnificent theaters to look at. When you walk into your town, he showed me the approach to Aosta, and it's like theater in stone. It's beautiful.
Sorry, that was a cat that I had to throw. Catapult off, yeah.
Various cat noises.
Yes.
They offer people something. It's like, okay, if you resist, we're going to kill you all. But, you know, there might be a few survivors, and they're going to have a good time. And that was different from, we're going to kill you all, period. Which was basically,
what have the Romans ever done for us? Besides the roads, the security. Oh yeah, you remember what this place used to be? All right, they did offer that, and it was very seductive. I mean, in some ways, you know, it's kind of similar to what the American Empire offers, and what it also offers is a lot of pain and misery when you get in the way. I mean, God, we don't read about it much, but when you look at what we did in Central America, just as one example, you really can make life miserable for people that that don't succumb. And then when they do succumb, well, it's not always a great deal, but they won't get mutilated in their villages at night or something. Yeah.
That's something we were talking about in the last show, the strange mental experience of having been alive during the Reagan era. And I lie awake a lot thinking about that, thinking about why certain things were not clear to me, but they weren't. Mm-hmm, that's all too. I can say is, you know, I knew bad things were happening in Nicaragua and El Salvador, but it wasn't very clear to me what was happening. It's bitterly clear now, and I wish I'd seen it sooner, but I didn't.
Yeah, well, I mean, as we talked about also, we reacted more to what was in front of us in our little world in the Bay Area, and everything else seemed like proxy arguments that really were local turf fights. But so let's move back to 1919 to 1923, the Greco-Turkish Wars real quickly, and then we can skip from there to maybe to the Burundi War. But and we are getting a little bit close towards the end, so can make it quick.
I'll try and speed it up.
Yeah.
The Greco-Turkish War has basically been a constant. I mean, Greeks and Turks have been at war in the Eastern Mediterranean for as long, you know, as there have been Greeks and Turks. I mean, the only time they haven't been at war is probably right now, and who knows how long that'll last. But Greece gained its independence in the early 19th century.
From the Ottomans.
The Ottomans. And then in 1918, the Ottoman Empire disintegrated. One of the casualties of that end of the First World War. And the Greeks naturally thought, as an expanding nationality with ancient links to Asia Minor, I mean, the Greeks had been a sea people, right? So they thought of the coast of what is now Turkey as Greek territory. Mm-hmm. They didn't so much care about what was inland, but they thought of all that as Greek, and it was Greek. I mean, the city that we now call Izmir was then called Smyrna, and it was a Greek city, bigger than Athens. 640,000 Greeks lived there, much more than the population of Athens at the time. And in addition, the Ottomans were an enemy power, which means that the French and the British were talking to their enemies, in this case, the Greeks, and messing with them. Just as the British messed with the Arabs and sent Lawrence to make them promises about Ottoman territories that they'd get, so the British and the French sent envoys to the Greeks to say, if you'll come in on our side, we'll give you all that Ottoman territory, you know, all that shoreline of Anatolia that you think of as Greek. And the Greeks believed Lloyd George, who was an amazing man, a genius, messed up in all kinds of ways, but a liar when dealing with people he didn't consider fully human, as he didn't consider the Greeks fully human. So the Greeks believe it. They sent 20,000 troops to Smyrna, Izmir, on the coast of Turkey in May 1919. Then they start pushing inland because they're trying to create a sort of defensible homeland for the coastal Greek territories. They originally signed a treaty with the what's left of the Ottomans that gives them Thrace, which is, you know, the what is now European Turkey, and the area of Smyrna. The war seems to be going well because the Ottomans have collapsed. The caliphate is over. But there's this guy named Mustafa Kemal, later to be known as Kemal Atatürk, or just Atatürk, who is one of the most incredible people of the 20th century, organizing a new Turkey, not an Ottoman Turkey, but a nationalist, secular Turkey, back around Ankara, as it was called then, Angora, in the center of the Anatolian Peninsula. The Greeks are advancing. They think everything is theirs. They have this idea of Megali Elena, Greater Greece. Like, you know, everybody has this idea of greater. We saw Greater Albania, with, you know, Yeretz, Yezreel. There's always some Greater Greece, and it's always a mistake to start pushing for that greater thing. Stick with what you got. You're better off. But then the Turks start to coalesce under this incredible guy, Atatürk, who's everything to everybody, who's a nationalist to the nationalist, a Muslim to the Muslim. Everyone rallies to him. He was one of the heroes of Gallipoli. The French, who are fighting the Turks in the south, give up. The Italians, who are also fighting them to the southwest, give up and switch sides and start helping the Turks.
We forget how much fighting was still going on. And all the—I mean, it just wasn't in the main fronts anymore. But there were all kinds of really violent, bloody wars between 1918 and I guess 21, 22, 23, right? Because it was also in the Eastern fronts as well.
Care more about the the upper class Western Europeans who died, because they did die in the trenches, but a lot of people who weren't upper class Western Europeans died too. In between 1900 and 1923, it's estimated that the Turkish massacres of Christian minorities alone were over 4 million people in Asia Minor. It was hellish, a huge hellish war with no mercy on any of the many different sides. And the Greeks, up until 1920, are pushing inland toward Ankara. They control the west of Anatolia. The British are supporting them all the way. It looks like they're going to have their greater Greece. But the Turks start to get help from a really interesting source, the Soviets, who are now in power. And the Soviets are kind of annoyed at the way the West is, because the West is also fighting against them on what would become the soil of the Soviet Union. And the the new Turkish administration says, here, we'll give you Batum in what is now southern.
That's how they got Batumi and Ajaria and all that. Okay.
Yep. They give them that, and Lenin says, okay, here's like 200 pounds of gold, here's 6,000 rifles, and they start to get better equipped. The Greeks stage a victory in 21, but they don't follow up. It was kind of like Chickamauga in the American Civil War. Big victory, but they hold in place. They don't seize the rail lines that could have ended the war for good. And then the Turks have finally coalesced under Ataturk. And when they coalesce, they are a force that just cannot be stopped. In August of 1921, the Turks attacked. It's this town with a Turkish name that I'm going to mess up. Dumlupinar. Okay, that's as close as I can get. Sorry to any Turks listening. The Greek army in August of 1922 is destroyed. The two commanding generals are captured. Most of the army is captured. Within a few weeks, Turkish cavalry is in Smyrna. And that's when what was already ugly gets even uglier. And all the Greek and Armenian neighborhoods in Smyrna burned to the ground. All the villages between central Anatolia and the coast that were occupied by Greeks, Armenian, and Assyrians or other Christian minorities are burned to the ground. The people in them are killed. The outcome is very, very clear. Turkey is a fascinating study in how a country reinvents itself. The Ottoman Empire, however brutal and cruel and unfair it was, did imagine itself as a sort of multilingual, multicultural thing. There was no sense of equality. It was a Muslim Turkish state. That was the ruler. But it admitted that there were other peoples inside that empire. Mm-hmm. Ataturk's Turkey took Wilson's talking points and just said, okay, if a nation is a unitary state composed of people who all speak the same language and all have the same culture, then I guess everybody in our state is going to have to be a Turk. And if there are people here who are not Turks, they're either going to have to become Turks or they're going to have to leave. And the unspoken part was, or be killed. So the leave part turned into something called, in a euphemistic kind of way, the exchange of population. A million and a half Greeks and Armenian survivors were sent, according to their religion, not the language they spoke, not their culture, just their religion, were sent to Greece. 500,000 Muslims, who were often ethnically Greek, were sent to what was now Turkey. So there was an explicit sectarian break, sort of like the India-Pakistan.
I was going to say the partition.
Sort of like that, and accompanied by a lot of horror, as those things generally are. And at the end of this, Turkey stopping this multicultural, if not equal, Ottoman Empire, and became the most unitary ethnic state I can think of. There are other states that are ethnically unitary, like, say, Korea, but those really are Korean. Like, pretty much everybody in Korea, as far as I know, is a Korean. It was never the case that everybody in Turkey is a Turk.
Right.
But it had to be under Ataturk's severe interpretation of Woodrow Wilson's ideas. It had to be that way so that Kurds, for example, were not allowed to be Kurds. They were not allowed to speak Kurdish. They were not allowed to define themselves as Kurdish. They were officially, quote, mountain Turks, sort of like hillbilly versions of Turks, because everybody in Turkey had to be a Turk. That was the way the new state was imagined. And it's really weird to think of that as derived, at least in part, from Ataturk's interpretation of the Wilsonian idea of the rights of small nations.
There's a lot of that, in a sense, isn't there? And it still goes on today. I mean, it carries on through the idea of democracies. And when democracies arise, it seems to spark a lot of a lot, oftentimes, you know, ethnic cleansings and massacres and so on as well, because, right? I mean,
That gets
seen
us
in
right
Burma.
And Burundi, that gets us right to Burundi. I mean, the majority in Burundi is Hutu. If the lakes, the African lakes, are a war between two peoples, Hutu and Tutsi, and Hutu are the majority, then democracy can rationally be interpreted as meaning we win the war because there are more of us. And that's a scary idea.
Yeah, I want to read, you had pointed out, the War Nerd on the Facebook page, the article in, is it All Africa? Is that what it's called?
It's an aggregate site with good news stories from all the African countries.
Right, and how do you, so the Hutus are French speaking as well as their native language, right? Because, like, the president's name is Pierre Nkurunziza.
Kurunziza. Yeah, I'm not sure how strong the N at the beginning is, because we're dealing with French transliteration of African names. You know, it's always complicated whether the English transliterated or the Italians or the French. It makes a lot of difference.
So it says here that on November 4th, so that would have been last week, a French news, so Liberation ran a headline, "In Burundi, a genocide is beginning." And here's a bit of a description in the African press. "The dead are turning up decapitated. Others have been butchered and their hearts ripped out in macabre scenes reminiscent of what Rwanda, Hutu militias." Hutus did to some of their victims in mid-1994. "Relatives of missing people are greeted by grossly battered bodies like that of the son of prominent human rights activist Pierre Claver Bonimpa, clubbed around the head and injured with brutality similar to what Ugandans, for instance, were used to in the 70s under the rule of Idi Amin." When protests broke out, I'm going to read a little bit more here because it's interesting. So basically, the president was supposed to finish his term, and he decided, no, I'm going to stay for another term. That caused protests to break out, I think, both Hutus and perhaps Tutsi. "So when protests broke out in the streets of the capital, police reacted with alacrity, fighting running battles with youths and other able-bodied men, demanding Nkurunziza respect the law and depart. The protests went on several weeks and were to claim a number of lives, both of civilians and security forces. Things got to a head in early August when armed people executed Nkurunziza's chief of internal security, the so-called Lieutenant General Adolphe Shimirimana, a hardliner detested and hated by many in Bujumbura, who attribute to him many deaths and massacres in and around the capital. In a hail of machine gun bullets," "in a hail of machine gun bullets, plus a couple of rocket-propelled grenade blasts for good measure, in the heart of
Bujumbura." I remember that line. I love that line.
And then the next line, too, the Burundian president, according to many sources in Bujumbura, the press, social media, and ordinary citizens became paranoid after that.
Yeah. Well, he's a slightly weird guy in his own right. I mean, he apparently thinks that God wants him to rule the country, which, you know, to us Americans is probably not such a strange idea. He has a football club called Hallelujah FC. This is a bloody part of the world. You know, he had seven siblings. Only one of them is still alive. The others were killed in this kind of ethnic violence. He was a Hutu militia leader from way back. And this did not start, as far as I can tell. And no one will speak honestly about this, so I'm just guessing. But as far as I can tell, this started more as his attempt to retain power with some of his friends. But when resistance developed to that, he found that ethnic hatred was the most useful weapon he could find.
Right.
So it's now become a purge directed against the Tutsi neighborhoods of Bujumbura. And the trouble with something like that is it can be very popular. I mean, Erdogan is like a slicker version of that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of real hatred of Kurds by Turkish nationalists, and a lot of Erdogan support comes from that. And there's probably a lot of real hatred of Tutsi among the Hutu silent majority, you know, in Burundi.
Mm-hmm.
these silent majorities are more common than people think.
Yeah, that's kind of how Modi got to power, too. He went into some states where the BJP didn't do well. They incited a lot of anti-Muslim communal violence that really wasn't there before. They used to actually vote as a block more along class and peasant lines.
Yep.
And they started dividing them up by talking about how Muslims slaughter cows. And the next thing you know, I think it was Uttar Pradesh, there were just massacres all across the whole state when Modi was campaigning there. And for the first time ever, the whole state turned BJP. But I think we're just about running over right now. So I think we're going to have to wrap it up.
Okay.
So you, when are you off to, you're off to Hungary next, right?
Yeah. If all goes well, we'll catch a plane to Hungary, to Budapest, where we're going to spend a month, and I'm looking forward to seeing what's going on there. In fact, if anybody is in Budapest, one thing I'd like to do is talk to some illustrators, because we need somebody to illustrate this Iliad. So if you can make the gods real and do some ultraviolence at the same time without being too cartoony about it, let's see what you got.
Okay, you hear that, listeners? If anybody is an illustrator, knows an illustrator, and is anywhere in the general vicinity of Budapest, get in touch with us, or you can write to radiowarnard@gmail.com. You can write to us. Also, thank you again to everyone for subscribing. We are just about now. Yeah, we're right about at the mark where we're going to go weekly. And as I wrote, we wrote in the last newsletter, I think we're going to switch over to a monthly payment rather than per show. I mean, we've been pretty good about sticking to the schedule, and I think it's been a bit confusing for some people, the per show rather than per month. So I think we're going to figure out how to do that. We're very slow technologically, so just bear with us. And, you know, this is, I mean, we, as two untechnological people, we have still managed to stick with this pretty well. You know, I'm kind of amazed that we know how to press play buttons and record buttons, you know, like this. So,
it's from some very weird locales at
So, again, thanks a lot to the Warnerd, Gary Brecher, aka John Dolan, and good luck to you and your wife on your next travels. You guys are, I mean, I would say you're jet setters, but I know you're not really jet setting. So
No, this is the first time we've taken something besides a bus, and it's about to break us. But anyway, no, thank you.
Okay.
All right. Well.
And and I don't know how you say goodbye in Turkish or Hungarian, but in any event, until the next time, and thank you to all of our listeners again, and all of our subscribers, especially thanks to you, we can keep doing this, and see you soon.
Okay.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.